I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Shortly after taking office, President Obama signed an executive order requiring that the Guantanamo Bay detention facility be closed within the year. He said the U.S. does not have to continue with a false choice between our safety and our ideals. He quickly faced opposition from both Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. Congress. Guantanamo remains open and suspects are being tried before military tribunals, something candidate Obama promised to end. Mr. Obama has also ordered numerous targeted killings of terror suspects using drone strikes. Our guest Daniel Kleibman writes about all of this in his new book, including the intense debates and arguments in the Obama White House over these policies. The book is called Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Administration. Daniel Kleibman is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, where he covers terrorism and national security. And Daniel Kleibman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Marty.
What is the most glaring difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration when it comes to the war on terror?
Well, it's a good question, and I think a lot of people will look at the two administrations' policies and conclude that there really is not a whole lot of difference. I think it's more complicated than that. First of all, President Obama, in his second day of office, did end one of the most controversial practices of the previous administration, the harsh interrogation procedures. Now, those had not continued all that much into the second term of the Bush administration, but there's no reason that they might not have started again. President Obama said, it's unlawful, it's against our values, we're not going to do it, and everything I've seen suggests that they have not been continued. There are other changes as well, and there are important tonal changes in the way that the president talks about what George Bush referred to as the war on terror, and other changes as well. But it is true that there's an enormous amount of continuity, probably more than Barack Obama would have anticipated, certainly when he was campaigning on these issues.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me just ask you about the tonal difference. Do you think it's also a linguistic difference about how these two administrations have talked about terrorism?
Yes, I think so. And again, you do have to make a distinction between President Bush's first term and his second term. I think he began to modulate the language somewhat in the second term. But as I mentioned, President Obama dispensed with the phrase war on terror. He says you can't have a war against a tactic. I think one of the things that he tried to do, and I think largely succeeded, was tone down some of what he thought was unproductive sort of fear-mongering. Remember, we used to have a color-coded system where if there was some sort of a threat, you would hear that we were at, orange level, and there was this kind of sense that sort of Obama talked about wanting to sort of break the fever a little bit and end the politics of fear. And I think he's largely been successful at doing that. I think, again, he didn't realize how difficult that would be, and that many of the things that he had wanted to do, like close Guantanamo, like try the 9/11 suspects in civilian courts, I think he genuinely wanted to do those things. He wasn't able to do because the politics of fear were still alive and well, despite the fact that he had tried to make some of these rhetorical changes and act differently.
Well, as you write, after Obama signed the executive order closing Guantanamo, he got resistance from Congress, and not just from the Republicans, but Democrats are pushing back hard against the administration on this closure.
That's exactly right. He had very little support, not just from centrist or conservative Democrats, but from liberal Democrats. They all felt vulnerable on this issue. They all felt like their opponent, either in a primary or a general election, would accuse them of trying to bring terrorists into into their constituents' neighborhoods. And so, liberals, throughout the party, were not particularly eager to help Obama close down Guantanamo. And without that kind of political support, would have been difficult to do. Now, they would say that the president didn't show enough will himself, he didn't come up with a plan, he made it harder for them, he didn't give them the kind of political cover they needed. The fact remains that he did not get support from within his own party to do some of these things.
He did make that speech at the National Archives about, quote, closing Guantanamo, about civilian trials, military commissions as a last resort. But those words were not enough to convince even members of his own party?
That's right. In the first few months, I think the administration held out hope that they would be able to find ways to change the narrative, to reframe the debate, to give a speech that would really change things. And in the end, it was not enough. There are some people who would say that the president flinched early on, that he made certain choices, if he had stuck to his guns, and engaged the Congress, he might have been more successful. One important turning point that I write about in my book along these lines is as early as April of 2009, so he'd only been in office for really 3 months. The president his administration has a plan to bring a small number of Guantanamo detainees, these were Chinese dissidents who had been cleared by the courts, to bring them into the United States to resettle them here. The idea was that we would not be able to persuade our allies, the Europeans, to take Guantanamo detainees if we didn't step up to the plate and do it ourselves. And so there was this plan, and it seemed it was, you know, risk-free in a security sense, but it wasn't in a political sense. And when word leaked of it, a Republican congressman named Frank Wolf from Virginia went to the House floor, gave a blistering speech about how the president was bringing terrorists into your neighborhoods, meaning the other members of Congress, started basically what I call a fear-induced insurrection against the policy of closing down Guantanamo. And opposition, it was basically a NIMBY rebellion, not in my backyard. He was never able to really contain that rebellion. And as a result, here we are 3.5 years later a large number of detainees still in Guantanamo.
Well, and you're talking about the Uyghurs, and they ended up in Bermuda, of all places.
They did. There were first two, then four Uyghurs who were supposed to be sent to Northern Virginia, and when word leaked that they were coming to the United States, the president killed the plan, and he said, "I'm not bringing them in." The problem was that essentially a contract with these Uyghurs saying that they could come in, we had something with them. A plan was hatched to send them to Bermuda. It was done secretly, but finally they ended up there. It very much proves that we could have brought them to the United States. They've lived, good lives there. They have not gotten into any trouble, it raises questions about, and I think for President Obama, it made the point that we still didn't have the resilience to deal with the politics of terrorism. If we couldn't bring in two or four innocent Chinese dissidents who had nothing to do with terrorism, who were no threat to the United States, how are we going to push back against all of the other politics in this area?
How many terror suspects are at Guantanamo? And, of course, these are suspects that will now face some kind of military tribunal. How many people are we talking about?
Well, when Obama came into office, there were about 240 terrorists or suspected terrorists at Guantanamo. Actually, quite a number of them had been cleared of terrorism charges, but no one would take them. There are now, I think the number is about 170, so they've moved the needle a little bit, but not much. The interesting thing is that there's a large number, I think about 48, of these suspects who can't be tried in civilian courts or military commissions, nor can they be released. These are people who we deem to be dangerous, but there may not be a legal case against them, either because they had been tortured or because there simply isn't the kind of evidence that would stand up in a court of law, but they clearly are dangerous because they trained in Osama bin Laden's camps or swore allegiance to al-Qaeda. And so one of the big questions that President Obama faced when he first came into office was, well, what do we do with these people? One of the things he was opposed to that the Bush administration had done was indefinite detention, detention mm-hmm. without trial. It went against sort of fundamental notions of American justice. And he struggled with this issue for months and months thought about it. He's a former law professor, thought about it in pretty complex terms. But at the end of the day, it was one of these huge legal and national security challenges. He just couldn't reconcile those issues, and they remain at Guantanamo. They won't be tried in military commissions or civilian courts, and nor will they be released. That makes it hard to shut down Guantanamo.
Well, and just picking up on that, and even looking at the title of your book, Kill or Capture, the president is told or says in your book, you know, we don't have a capture policy. Has that then led to the drone strike policy of the Obama administration?
Well, the book is called Kill or Capture because that is has been one of the central dilemmas that the administration has faced, and serves as a kind of a metaphor for many of these very mm-hmm. difficult dilemmas in this area. It is much easier to kill than it is to capture, this administration has learned. Now, that is largely because these suspected terrorists are in very remote places where we can't operate or where it's very difficult to operate. We're not allowed to send our troops into Pakistan. In Yemen, it's the same situation. Somalia is a very difficult place. We have a long history there. People remember Black Hawk Down, where a lot of Americans were killed. Presidents are very reluctant to send troops to places like Somalia. So that is the primary reason that we have not captured a lot of people. But everyone I talked to said, in the back of their minds, even if it wasn't always discussed explicitly, the fact that we didn't have a detention policy created these kind of perverse incentives for killing more people than capturing them. And so they understood that it was untenable and that they were going to have to figure out some kind of a detention policy. The problem was bringing them to Guantanamo was now not a possibility because the president was committed to closing Guantanamo. That was a major presidential promise. Politically, it would look very bad if any started bringing more detainees to Guantanamo. On the other hand, the Congress was making it increasingly difficult and finally impossible to bring detainees to the United States, and so they were really in a jam. There are a lot of people who believe, although I didn't uncover explicit evidence of it, there are a lot of people who believe that many more people are being killed rather than captured because of the complications surrounding detention. And just one more point on
that. Well, you know what? If you don't mind, only because we're up on a break here, we'll get
sure.
to that one more point after this very short break.
Sure.
Talking with Daniel Kleidman today on Radio Times. He's a special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He covers terrorism and national security, and he's the author of a new book called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Much to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view now through September 30th, Dive Deep, Eric Fischel and the Process of Painting. Major works by internationally acclaimed artist Eric Fischel, known for his representational work focusing on the American suburban experience and the language of human bodies. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org. pafa.org.
Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are October 6th or November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at whyy.org/American Graduate.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad.
I said, who are the smartest guys you have who want to work on developing something that will pump water from sunshine?
Global demand for water is increasing along with the world's population, and sanitation is an issue in many places, making water management a crucial issue. the Global Water Challenge, next on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Daniel Klaibman about his book. The book is about the heated debates in the White House about how to deal with the threat of terrorists. The book called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Klaibman is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Do you remember your one more thing, Daniel Klaibman?
Yes, I do. I was talking about the fact that it's been very difficult for this administration to capture suspected terrorists, and they have been more likely to kill them. The problem with that is that capturing terrorists is extremely important in fighting terrorism, because when you capture someone, you're able to learn about your organization, you're able to learn about how they raise money, about possible impending plots and attacks against the United States. And, you know, as the old saying goes, dead men don't tell tales. Mm. So they would much rather, I think, capture terrorists where possible. I know that's true of people in the military and the CIA, but for a variety of reasons, that has not been possible. In fact, they've only really captured one significant terrorist outside of Afghanistan in the 3.5 years that Obama has been president.
Well, you also describe the not just the heated debates about these policies, but also the procedure that has put into place to try to figure out when and how and where and why to have these targeted killings. Help us understand, I guess, the back and forth that goes on as a suspect is chosen for target, and then the president makes the ultimate decision about whether to order the drone strike or not.
That's right. That's an important part of my book. What I tried to do in this book is to sort of lay bare the human dimensions of national security decision making. These are people throughout the national security bureaucracy and all the way up to the president who I think are genuinely struggling with these very difficult issues, and often making the ultimate decision whether to kill someone or to spare someone. And you know, I think for the most part people take these decisions very seriously. What happens is on the military side, because the military has its own targeted killing program, and it's a distinction that I actually is important to make. Right. There's the CIA program, which is a covert program. The President of the United States generally approves that program, but he doesn't approve individual strikes. Then there's the military program, which also does targeted killing, also does drone strikes in places like Yemen and Somalia. And the President has decided that he wants to sign off on those individual strikes. What happens is the military will nominate a target. That's the phrase they use, nominate a target. And then there's a fairly vigorous interagency vetting process where as many as 75 or 100 officials from throughout the government, from the Defense Department, from the CIA, from the State Department, from the National Security Council and the White House, will gather on a secure video conference, and they'll go through all of these complicated questions. Do we have the legal authority to go after this particular target? Is it the right thing to do from a moral perspective, from a policy perspective? If we go after this target, what's the risk of killing civilians, innocent women and children, or collateral damage, to use the phrase that is commonly employed? And they go through this, and finally a recommendation is brought to the president, generally by his chief counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, or for most of his presidency, a man named Hoss Cartwright, who was the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then the president will make the ultimate decision. Hmm. You know, sometimes they'll have to bring these choices to President Obama during very awkward times. They've pulled him out of state dinners in the past. Occasionally they've gone to him while he's having dinner or family time with the First Lady or the president's children. The president has to make these grim decisions.
Well, when that decision makes its way up to the, or when that choice, I guess, makes its way up to President Obama, Are they talking about an individual, or are they talking about someone that meets certain characteristics that makes all those people that weighed in on this decision think that this is a terrorist? I mean, I guess the question is, how certain are they that they know who they are killing?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think ultimately they can't know for sure in all instances. You know, there is a fog of war that can't be entirely lifted. You know, for the most part, they are depending on human intelligence, and as we all know, humans can make mistakes. And so, in fact, the president, on his third day of office, was told early in the morning by his chief counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, that the very first drone strikes of his presidency had been launched, and unfortunately, they'd gotten the wrong person. They'd killed a tribal elder in North Waziristan and in Pakistan, who was completely innocent, and killed him and much of his family. And the president was very troubled by this. He called in the CIA and wanted to understand what had happened. And they explained to him that, you know, war is messy, and even these drones, which had been described to him as being so precise and accurate, sometimes can miss their targets.
Is there any precedence for a president to sign off on the individual killing of a terror suspect or an enemy suspect of the United States?
Certainly not in such a systematic way and in such large numbers, as far as I could tell. You know, President Roosevelt signed off on the killing of the Japanese military official who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, that in a sense was a targeted killing, and so and it was signed off on by the president himself. But that was one instance. Here we're talking about, you know, hundreds of cases, and you know, president's advisors coming to him on a regular basis and asking him to sign off on these targeted killings. So that is we sort of crossed a Rubicon. It's interesting, and I think important to understand why President Obama did this. I think it's certainly not because he didn't think that there was enough killing going on. Remember that President Obama inherited a military that had been molded and shaped by President Bush, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, that was very much on the offensive in the war on terror. And President Obama, who had no military experience himself, I think was wary of what he called mission creep, or sometimes requirement creep. That if he and the White House didn't exercise sort of supervision over the military, there were dangers that we would get sucked into military conflicts, open new fronts in the war on terror in some of these places where Al Qaeda and its affiliates were operating. And he was the president who had been elected, at least in part, to wind down the wars of 9/11. The last thing he wanted to do was to open up new fronts. So much of the reason, I think, that he decided he wanted to exercise this kind of supervision over the military's targeted killing program was because he was concerned that we would get too deeply involved in war in some of these places.
Does anyone know whether he has signed off on all these targeted killings or not?
I know from my reporting that in many instances he rejected the military's he did not give approval to some targeted killings that the military had asked him to approve. I mean, for example, in the summer of 2011, this was after Osama, not long after Osama bin Laden had been killed, and the military wanted to stay on the offensive and go after Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula much more aggressively. This was the Al Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. And they came to him with a large number of targets, one operation in which they were going to go after 11 targets at once. That had never been done before in Yemen. The president and some of his advisors around him were concerned about that. This was one of these signature strikes where you go after a significant number of people at once. You don't necessarily know all of their identities. And the president said, no, I don't want to go after all of them. I don't want to get embroiled in some civil war in Yemen. I want to make sure that we know exactly who we're going after, that we remain, as he would put it, AQ-focused, focused on demonstrable threats to the United States from known al-Qaeda terrorists. And so in that instance, he scaled back the list. I think he did that on many occasions.
And that's Daniel Kleibman, our guest today in Radio Times. We're talking about his new book called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And our guest writes about national security and terrorism for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And we're taking questions, comments. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Perhaps one of the most controversial of these decisions was to kill the American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki. He was in Yemen at the time. And the way you write, it sounds as if the president was determined to kill him. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think that would be a fair assessment. I think if he could have if he felt he could have captured him, I think he would have been willing to do that. But we were not allowed to operate on the ground in Yemen where al-Awlaki was hiding out, and so he wanted to eliminate al-Awlaki as a threat. This was his main priority after Osama bin Laden had been killed, and the president was really obsessed with getting al-Awlaki because he had seen all of the evidence that al-Awlaki was, you know, really hell-bent on killing Americans and attacking the homeland. He was behind the Christmas Day attempted bombing, Christmas 2009. He was behind a number of other attempted attacks on the United States. He was an enormously charismatic recruiter of terrorists. Many other terrorists who had been picked up, had said that they'd been inspired by al-Awlaki. So President Obama considered al-Awlaki to be a very, very serious threat to the United States. And frankly, he was not terribly, there was not a lot of hand-wringing about the fact that he was an American citizen. He determined that killing al-Awlaki was a legitimate and necessary act of war. And interestingly, I find Obama, throughout my reporting, struggling with a lot of the moral and legal questions surrounding these policy decisions, not when it came to al-Awlaki. I don't think he lost any sleep over the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, which I think would surprise many of President Obama's liberal supporters.
Is there any way to know whether these targeted killings have in any way defeated al-Qaeda or terrorist organizations? Because when there is a mistake, obviously it's a tragic mistake when civilians are killed as a result of some of these strikes. Hamid Karzai, for instance, is opposed to them. But it can also be used as a recruitment tool to get more people to join terrorist organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something that President Obama was aware of and thought about, but ultimately decided that his responsibility... I don't think President Obama harbored any illusions that the drone program was the kind of strategic weapon that could end terrorism. I think he did believe that the use of drones, particularly in Pakistan, dealt a very heavy blow to al-Qaeda. I think the administration would say that they have achieved the near strategic dismantlement, if not defeat, of al-Qaeda. For one thing, suspected terrorists, they live in fear of these drones for good reason. It disrupts them. They can't train nearly as much. It's harder to raise money. It's harder to replenish the pipeline of recruits coming in. And so that makes it extremely difficult for al-Qaeda to be able to strike out, at least from Pakistan. They've had to rely more on their affiliates in places like Yemen and Somalia and perhaps now other places in Africa. But I talked to people, some of his closest advisors, about this very question. They said, yes, he was concerned about blowback and about how this would be a recruiting tool for terrorists. On the other hand, he said, presidents spend much of their time worrying about the individual terrorist who manages to elude our security, to get through the system and attack people in Times Square or where have you, he was very preoccupied with stopping that individual terrorist. And a drone strike can do that, and he believed that it was a valuable weapon, not to the exclusion of all of the other things that you need to do to deal with the scourge of terrorism, and some of that is soft power as well. But it is interesting how a president who came in emphasizing soft power ended up relying so much more on hard power.
Why do you think drone strikes have gotten so much criticism, not from everybody, but certainly from some vocal groups and individuals, but airstrikes don't seem to have that same kind of visceral negative reaction?
It's a fascinating point, and I think there are a number of reasons for them. I think, first of all, it's a new technology, there's something almost about the precision and accuracy of the technology that I think is a little bit scary to people. Even though there is the potential for real humanitarian advances because they are relatively speaking precise. I think one of the reasons people are spooked by drones is because there's a sense in which it makes killing perhaps too easy. That if we don't have to put our troops on the ground or put them at risk, and we can fire these weapons from thousands of miles away, there's a sense in which it almost maybe dulls our moral sensibilities. When you have to kill people from close up, you have a more visceral, to use your word, sense of the tragedy of war. If you're doing it from a cubicle in Langley or some Air Force base in Nevada, at least the theory is that it's much more remote, not just physically, but emotionally and morally. I think it's a little more complicated than that. I quote in my book a CIA drone operator who is pushing back at the notion that he has a PlayStation mentality, that what he's doing is like playing a video game. He is a former Air Force pilot. He drew this distinction between comparison between dropping bombs. He said, "I used to drop bombs from airplanes, and I would drop my payload. I had no idea who was down there and who was going to be killed. Now I do this from thousands of miles away, but I linger over a target for hours. I see my target sometimes playing with his children, sometimes with his wife, and I wait. I have no compunction about blowing this person to kingdom come," he said, "but I'll wait until he's alone before I pull the trigger." And then he said, "And then sometimes I'll see this person's mother or wife come out, and I'll see them in mourning position. And then I'll see them go to the funeral, and I can watch the funeral." In one way, that's really chilling to hear that. On the other hand, the point he's making is, I can see the faces of the people I'm killing. In some ways, I'm closer to it than someone who's dropping a bomb from 25,000 feet over the target.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Daniel Kliveman and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Are you frustrated with your son or daughter who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued, threatened, or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend individual sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and help improve your relationship with your teen. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the AIDS epidemic in the African American community.
If Black America were a nation separate and apart, its HIV infection rates would rival that of many nations in sub-Saharan Africa.
We'll talk with public health analyst Dr. Robert Fullilove and Renata Simone, the director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, Endgame. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up. plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Daniel Kleibman. He's a special correspondent for Newsweek and for the Daily Beast and author of a new book called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. We are talking about the failed efforts to close Guantanamo Bay, talking about military tribunals and the use of drone strikes against terror suspects in far-flung parts of the world, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in, and then I would like to talk about the debates within the White House, because I think they're pretty illuminating. But first, we have Stephen from Ocean City joining us on Radio Time. Stephen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a physician, and this sounds very sick for our society. When have we become a country where a president or a civilian in the CIA can commit murder in countries we are not at war with, like Yemen and Somalia? And to hear the guest talking about the Orwellian language of signature strikes for killing 11 people in one day in Yemen, I call that mass murder. And the American people have to begin to understand that there's a law passed in the Congress in 2012, this year, that by 2015, American airspace will be opened up to drones that both have the capacity for surveillance and militarized drones. Now the American people are the enemy, and police departments are buying up these drones. And again, the intimacy of seeing the face of someone who's shortly to be blown up. The guest.
Let me take your point, and let me give our guest a chance to respond to what you said. Is that correct, Daniel? That their U.S. airspace is being opened up to drones.
You know, I don't. In some respects, yes. I know that the Department of Homeland Security has used drones for surveillance on the border. There's even been talk about the EPA using drones for surveillance. Also, it is not clear to me that drones are being used for military purposes domestically. Certainly, the United States military is not allowed to operate. Nor is the CIA allowed to operate domestically. That violates certain laws. But you know, there's a lot of concern about drones even being used for surveillance by the police. I think those are legitimate questions. I think they ought to be raised and discussed. It's not the focus of my book. I would like to say, just in response to the caller's points about this being murder. There are people who argue that the administration. And both Republicans and Democrats who are involved in these national security decisions would make a legal distinction between murder and lawful acts of war. One of the very complicated legal issues that the caller, I think, rightly alluded to was when you're doing this kind of activity in places where we are not in a declared state of war, like in places like Yemen and Somalia. And that is a tough question. The authority under which the administration has used these drone strikes in those places is the authorization for the use of military force, which was passed after 9/11, that basically says, you know, we can go after al-Qaeda or its affiliates or anyone who is associated with a group that was involved in the attacks on 9/11. We can go after them pretty much anywhere.
And the idea that in the last 10 years or so, al-Qaeda has morphed into a different kind of organization. Of course, it doesn't have the leader that it had in 2001, Osama bin Laden.
That's right. And in some ways, you know, it's ironic. Our successes in Pakistan has splintered the organization and made it in some ways more difficult, more legally problematic going after al-Qaeda in all of these other parts of the world.
Stephen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Daniel, going back to these debates that you write about within the Obama administration, the president, I'm not sure if he's caught between these two sides or listening to two sides, the realists, I guess, the idealists, and whether there was a team of rivals that were debating this issue within the Obama White House. Give us a flavor for just how intense these debates have been.
Oh, they've been very intense. And, you know, there's always, across all areas of policy, there are divisions between, you know, what we call the realists or the pragmatists and the idealists. And but in the area of national security, in the area of these very difficult moral questions about life and liberty and security and life and death, the tensions, you know, in some ways become much more acute, and as they should. And in this administration, and I think with this president, who I think he did get caught between his own impulses, his high-minded idealistic impulses. You know, he's a civil libertarian. He studied these issues closely, and his more pragmatic and sometimes political instincts. You know, he inherited a country, a government that was, you know, very deep in recession. The possibility of a depression still existed. He had to make some choices. He made a choice to pursue health care reform, for example, which I think he thought over the long term was, you know, critical to the economy. Presidents only have so much capital, and so he had to make certain priorities. Well, it took a while before he actually chose those priorities, and while he was kind of floating above the debate, there was very intense warfare between these two camps. They were called Tammany Hall. Those were the more politically minded people in the White House, and the Aspen Institute, which was an allusion to a more liberal, left-leaning think tank in Washington. Those were the idealists. And sometimes, you know, these debates spilled out into, you know, real shouting matches with, you know, profanity-laced shouting matches in the West Wing of the White House, even almost a physical confrontation at one point between David Axelrod, the president's senior advisor, and Eric Holder, the attorney general. They had to be separated by Valerie Jarrett, the president's very close friend and senior advisor. She told them, you know, take it out of the hallway. So very intense arguments and infighting. You know, in some ways it's healthy. Mm-hmm. These are important, extremely difficult issues, and sometimes out of that kind of dialectic you get the right policies.
Well, interestingly, and it seems that many of these debates were Eric Holder on one side and then the more sort of political arm of the Obama administration on the other side. But the Justice Department, as you write, prepared a 400-page briefing to prosecute Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in civilian court. And that was essentially, you know, shot down by the more political wing of the Obama administration.
Yeah, that decision was made after the White House realized how politically problematic these issues were, and Rahm Emanuel, who was then the chief of staff, basically didn't want Holder to make that decision. He thought it would make them vulnerable to charges that they were being weak on terrorism by trying these suspects in civilian courts rather than military commissions. He thought that it would be a real distraction in terms of the domestic agenda. And frankly, to his credit, he, I think, also believed that if they did this, it would be impossible to close down Guantanamo, because one of the key opponents to civilian trials was the senator, the Republican senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who was also in favor of closing Guantanamo, and they believed that if they had Lindsey Graham's support, he would have been able to bring other Republicans along. They might have actually been able to close Guantanamo. Eric Holder disagreed. He thought this was a matter of both principle, but also pragmatism. Mm-hmm. He actually believed that trying these suspects in civilian courts would be more effective than military commissions, which were untested and didn't have the experience that prosecutors in civilian courts did. That was a very brutal battle between the White House and Holder. It ended up not turning out well for Holder.
Well, interestingly, President Bush wanted to close Guantanamo, and terrorists and terror suspects have been tried in civilian courts before. This would not be a first time if it were to happen with one of the suspects from Guantanamo, realizing, of course, those are in a special category, but nonetheless.
Yeah, they've been tried in civilian courts hundreds of times, and there is, in my reporting, I think I learned that the civilian courts were easily as tough and resilient and effective as military commissions, but that's not the perception out there. People, I think that these military commissions, you know, because it's the military, you know, are tougher, and that there was less of a chance of these suspects, you know, sort of being freed, you know, on technicalities. You know, the irony is that because the military commissions had this reputation among civil libertarians and internationally as not being legitimate, the military was bending over backwards to do whatever they could to insist that they were as fair as civilian courts. And one thing I uncovered in my reporting is that at Guantanamo, the 9/11 suspects were being routinely, their conversations were being surreptitiously recorded. And in those conversations, they freely admitted to having been involved in the 9/11 attacks. That's really important evidence because it was not coerced. These were as I said, free admissions. And the military refused to use that that evidence. They refused to even listen to the recordings because they believed that it would be thrown out in court as being improperly intrusive. Whereas the civilian judges, there's no question, we use that kind of courthouse, those kinds of courthouse confessions and recordings all the time. So that's an example where clearly these civilian courts were more resilient, were tougher than the military commissions, but that's not the way it played politically.
One quick question, and I do want to get back to our callers. You had mentioned closer to the top of the hour about 40 or 50 of these terror suspects in Guantanamo that cannot be tried. Can we imagine that they would spend the rest of their lives in Guantanamo?
Well, that is not necessarily Guantanamo. I think the idea was that we would be able to close down Guantanamo and then bring those suspects to prisons in the United States where, you know, we have people who, you know, hundreds of, not thousands of people who are serving life sentences and they would be in some maximum security prison, like other terrorists are, and that was the plan. But they couldn't be released because they were believed to be very dangerous, and nor could they be tried for those reasons. It took President Obama quite some time to agree that these people could be held indefinitely, but ultimately he did.
Mm. Let me get Charles from Pottstown to join our conversation. Charles, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Okay. I read in, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, that after they make a strike on a target, they will then wait till the rescuers come out, or just curious people see what went on. They'll then make a second strike on that area and kill whoever gathers around the body. Is that true?
Daniel Clinton?
You know, I did not uncover that in my own reporting. I've read that as well. I don't believe they're trying to do is then kill the rescuers. But I suppose if they do often linger after a strike to see what happens, and I suppose if they see someone else who they believe to be associated with terrorism, they might strike, and in those events, perhaps they do. I think that's, if that's what's happening, I think that is very controversial.
But we're talking about people literally looking at a screen, right, Daniel?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
But we're talking about people that are looking at a screen, let's say where they have targeted somebody and then looking at the aftermath of that target?
That's right. I think that's what the caller is referring to.
Right. Charles, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Ed from Villanova has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, your guest has said that the Obama administration has stopped torturing prisoners. But isn't the rendition program ongoing, a program started by the Clinton administration, something especially cowardly and ugly that's been going on for years?
It's a good question, Ed. Thanks for the call. Daniel, go ahead.
It is a good question. This administration has continued to support rendition. I think they are doing it in smaller numbers than had been done during the Bush administration. I don't have the figures for the Clinton administration. He's right. This is a policy that did begin back during the Clinton administration. So both Democratic and Republican presidents have supported it. I know in some instances, like in the one capture that I referred to earlier, this was a Somali member of the Shabab who was a important liaison between the Shabab and the AQAP, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. They captured him. They put him on a boat for 70 days trying to decide what to do with him. One of the options was to render him. They decided that they did not want to do that. They were concerned about how he would be treated. They were also concerned that they wouldn't be able to get the intelligence they wanted out of him if they sent him to another country, and so they brought him to the Southern District of New York, to Manhattan, to put on trial here. Now, that's the one instance when that happened. My assumption is that in many more instances, they've rendered people that they've captured, and that does raise questions about how they're being treated when they send them to countries like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, where we know torture has taken place. So it's a very legitimate and important question.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. Daniel Kleidman, we have to end our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Daniel Kleidman, our guest. The book is called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. He's a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and joined us today on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts, email, archives, Facebook, Twitter. It's all there. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.